Thank you. We have a recommendation here to establish a pool of investment or investment legal counsel firms. This is something we brought back to the board in May. We had a discussion about the volume of work that we anticipated engaging in, for particularly in private equity space, now that we're kind of going in more of a direct space, and highlighting the need for more breadth in our investment legal counsel, in the firms that work with us on investment legal counsel work. Historically, we've worked with Reed Smith exclusively, so every investment management agreement, every limited partnership agreement has gone through them. We felt it prudent to kind of expand that going forward, so we issued an RFP back in June or so. Over the course of the summer, an internal committee of myself and Karen and Gail reviewed the responses. We got a dozen responses. We focused on the four firms that we're recommending today, really based upon their areas of expertise, their knowledge of California public pension law, and their cost effectiveness. So these are the four firms we'd like to bring forward to the board. We have Foley and Lardner, Jackson Walker, K&L Gates, and Reed Smith. I think each of the firms has a slightly different area of expertise. I think their costs are all kind of clustered in a relatively narrow band, based upon what we expect to pay, and gives us the optionality for if we have a legacy program issue that's coming up that Reed Smith has worked on in the past, certainly we continue to have the conversation with Reed Smith. If it's a private equity fund that we think we need to, you know, particular area of expertise on structuring the side letter agreement, we have a lot of firms who have that expertise. If it's a very non-standard approach, Foley and Lardner tends to kind of play in that non-standard approach area. So that gives us a lot of breadth there. We do have all four firms here, so the board can meet with them, understand their backgrounds, understand the partners that would work with us, that sort of thing. But really just kind of want to, we can jump right into the discussion with the managers, but I wanted to open it up as for a forum for any questions from the trustees at this point.
Okay. Sure. I had a couple of questions.
Sure.
Capacity, lack of conflicts, I get that.
Yep.
You've kind of suggested, and maybe you've already answered this question, that the differentiation and the expertise is enough from firm to firm? Because it seems to me there'd be a lot of overlap. Is that specialized from firm to firm?
There is a lot of overlap. So I think a lot of this is going to come down to when we have a particular fund, what we want to see is that there's a lack of conflict, so that they're not working for the general partner and the limited partner, ideally. Sometimes you can create a firewall there,
yeah.
But the idea would be we are contracting with fund, you know, Blue Lake Fund 5, and we would go out to these managers and say, are you working with Blue Lake Fund 5 either on the limited partner side or on the general partner side? If they're the counsel on the general partner side, we're going to move on to another firm there. This is also something where if we had five projects coming up at once and one firm couldn't handle all five projects, we might just parse that out across a couple of different firms here. So the overlaps in the areas of expertise are significant, but we want to have that overlap simply so that we know that in the event of a conflict, we've got a lot of other options there.
Yeah. Okay, the second part is the fees I thought were interesting. In our past, I mean, just by way of example, in the reviews that we've done with Reed Smith in the past, do you recall whether or not we may have exceeded the cap that is mentioned in the Foley and Lardner fees? Because I consider that to be an interesting concept.
It is an interesting concept, and we did go back and take a look at our experience with Reed Smith across a number of different projects over the past couple of years. And our internal accounting kind of breaks legal costs out on a month-by-month basis, so we've kind of reassembled into a project-by-project basis. So take this with a grain of salt, but directionally correct. For the simplest contracts, we were probably in the sub $5,000 cost. For the most complicated, we're just north of $20,000. So, I mean, it's definitely, that fixed rate is definitely in the middle of what we've experienced with Reed Smith over the past few years.
But obviously in one instance, they far exceeded a mythical cap, if there was one.
Yes.
At 20,000.
Yep.
Maybe the other three firms would be interested in proposing something along the same lines.
The other three firms have put forth their proposals, so we can certainly ask, but I think it's a Foley & Lardner definitely follows a different business model on that front, and I think there's some benefit to that structure in terms of knowledge and certainty of cost. I'd say if it isn't very complicated, they're going to come back and say, the $12,005 is actually more of a $15,000 or a $17,000, but we'll know that in advance of assigning anything to them. So $12,500 would be the typical.
So you're saying it's a soft cap?
It's a soft cap. It's a typical cap. Yeah.
So it could go under. What if it could go under as well as could go over?
Yes. And I think if it's something simple, we're not going to agree to a $12,500.
Right, that's what's getting at.
We're probably going to go to an hourly rate with somebody else.
Right.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the size of the pool, we actually had a number of internal conversations on this. And part of it is the conflicts of interest issue, as well as bandwidth of each of the firms. And we know that we're going to have a number of deals coming down the pipeline over the next few years. And we didn't want to have a situation where we're having to go back to the board and do an RFP because we have conflicts or, right. So that's kind of how we landed on the four.
Okay.
And I think at the end of the day, when it comes to fees, I think that we're looking at probably the most cost-effective solution from the proposals that we've received and comparing to what we've paid historically as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'll jump in. Just a quick comment coming out of a fee by the hour world. There are lots of implications if you have caps that are rigid on quality. There's a very high incentive to limit the number of hours times the hourly rate to the cap to some degree at our risk. So I like a soft cap. The second we had 12, we fairly quickly identified four,
mm-hmm.
And ended up proving that four. Any description of the breakpoint and how the eight didn't get selected fairly quickly? What caused you to go just to the four?
I think, and Gail and Karen, feel free to chime in as well, but I think number one was experience in California. The firms did not have extensive experience with public funds in California. It was going to be harder to kind of get to the finish line. Number two would be cost. There was a couple of firms where the cost was 2 to 3x what we're seeing here. Which we felt was probably, we didn't see a value for service proven out in the RFP process. I think those were the two biggest factors, really, yeah.
Do any of these have a California, not that it matters, office either in the city or down south or anything like that?
I'm sorry?
Do they even have local offices in California?
K&L Gates has a San Francisco office.
Obviously Reed Smith.
Reed Smith has a San Francisco office, but not for the investment.
Okay.
Well, they have people scattered in a lot of different places. But Jackson Walker is Texas only, and Foley & Lardner is this team that we've been working with is Boston-based.
Okay. Doesn't matter, just more
I think this is a case where all four of the firms are active in California, and we're somewhat agnostic about where they happen to base themselves.
Do we really need to hear from them? I don't know how the rest of the board feels. I mean, they want
to
know
how you feel.
Well, I mean, as we know, they're only going to come up and tell us how great they are. So,
well, if you have any questions about how they're structured, who the partners are,
okay.
What their areas of expertise are, we played it safe and said, let's have them here. They can answer any questions the board has.
So the Foley folks came out from Boston?
Yes.
I had the same reaction Gabe did, which is that I was prepared to deal with the item without seeing them, but if they've come all this way, I kind of feel bad if we don't do that.
You can do the 3-minute
version. All of them together, or meeting with each one separately?
My suggestion would be each separately, so you can actually ask focus questions. They can give you an honest answer. They rotate out, and the next firm would come in.
Good. Okay.
You can certainly limit their time and ask them to focus on their experience and have them tell you about their experience doing this kind of work for a similar fund. And to get you comfortable with the idea of us working with them, I think that would be prudent.
Okay.
Perhaps Mr. Hickey could, just touch on the Red Sox season and let us know how that worked out.
Not well.
Of course,
Mr.
the Giants.
We've been out to the glass house. We didn't have much to talk.
Are there any upfront retainer costs?
No. So this is, we would have engagement letters with each firm. There's zero cost unless we assign a project to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give me a sense of when you're negotiating an IMA or a side letter, how much of your time does it require?
It varies dramatically. If we're simultaneously negotiating legal terms and business terms, it's going to take quite a bit of my time. If this is strictly the business terms are set and we're getting all the fiduciary language into a side letter, very little.
And kind of given the need to expand the pool from Reed Smith to four providers total, the number of funds in the pipeline, how much of your time going forward do you think will be consumed by?
I think relatively little. We look forward and say the private equity realm is probably going to take up the bulk of the activity, or is going to have, that's where the bulk of the activity is going to be for the next several years. We do anticipate having an investment officer focused on the private markets. That individual would probably be spending their time with the legal counsel. From my seat, relatively little time other than in an oversight role. Say, is this working? Are costs coming in where we expect them to? Is there good communication? That sort of thing. But it's really going to be that private markets investment officer taking point on a lot of this. If it obviously is something major, I'll step into it, but I would anticipate that less of my time would be focused on engaging with the law firms going forward than it is today.
But it would underscore the need or the usefulness of having a private markets IO.
Yes.
Okay. Along with the lines of what Karen said, maybe you could let them know we're looking for a narrow focused discussion.
We have let them know in advance.
Okay.
I told them 15 minutes. Focus on the highlights of the firm, areas of expertise, that sort of thing. We can shrink it to 10 minutes if you'd like, at board chair discretion.
Yeah, I think 10 minutes.
Here we go. All right.
I'll make a motion of 10 minutes.
Well, you were making the motion of 0 minutes, so 10 it is.
All right. If other questions, we'll go ahead and bring them in just in alphabetical order. Great.
Thank you,
Chuck. How about them Red Sox?
I would have voted for the 0.
Yeah. They'd probably be happy, but that was nice. You're right. Yeah, you have a good point.
Cross-country flight.
Yeah. That's your back.
Not that good.
You'll recognize your key. It's a Sarah or a Sacred Meetings.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Yes, that's fine.
So I understand from your CIO you'd like a brief 10 minutes as far as that goes. And I said to my friends who I've known many of them sitting outside, I said, somebody time me. If I go beyond 10 minutes, somebody rap on the door as far as that goes. Thank you. My name is Tom Hickey. I'm a partner in the law firm of Foley & Lardner. We are a law firm of about 900 lawyers, and I hold the title that I go by, which is the head of what we call the Investment Management and Fund Formation Group. And I have about 100 lawyers that work on my team with me. And we represent several hundred institutional investors throughout the world, so that in your wonderful state, our clients would include San Bernardino County Employees Retirement Association, Orange County Employees Retirement System, San Francisco, the Ventura County, City of Fresno. We've got a number of them out here. We would also represent some of the larger state systems throughout the country. Arizona State Retirement System as an example, State of Delaware Retirement System. We were also counsel to the City of New York. And as some of you may know, the City of New York has five pension plans that administratively are run separate and distinct from each other. So you would have New York City Police, New York City Fire, New York City Teachers. Collectively, they invest as one. And it's done through the city comptroller's office. So the investment staff, the legal staff, are employed by the city comptroller, and the city comptroller is technically my client. But they've got about $174 billion in assets under management. So we also work with a number of pension plans overseas. And what we try to do for the 40-plus years that I've been doing this, and I should point this out, I got my start, believe it or not, when I was in my first year of law school. It was February of 1974, and we had a what we call in law school a moot court competition, oral arguments. My partner and I happened to win it, and we're given the opportunity to go to work at the State House in Boston. And you could get a job, you could work 20 hours a week and still go to law school full-time back then. And they'd offer you an hourly rate of $5 an hour. And I was thrilled to get that because my wife and I were getting married that summer in August of 74, and to have an extra $100 was terrific. What was my project? The project that no one else wanted. And that is, we knew in February of 74 that the federal government was looking at maybe taking over private pension plans. And my job was to go through the Massachusetts statutes and determine that if the federal government did enact such a law, what statutes would have to be repealed? Because prior to, as it turned out to be, the adoption and enactment of ERISA on Labor Day of 1974, states regulated private pension plans. And therefore, each state had to go through the process of removing those statutes. So I had that for those few months between February and June of 1974, and got back to school to start my second year of law school in September, got called to the dean's office. Never a good thing on your first day back to school. And the dean said, "Tom, we've been contacted by the State House staff. Would you like to be appointed to work on a task force out of Washington that is going to study public pension systems?" Because there was an outside section of ERISA that called for a study of whether there should be a Public Employee Retirement Income Security Act, a PERISA. And I spent my second and third year of law school traveling throughout the country and meeting with what would have been your predecessors to determine what were your statutory requirements, what was going on. We spent 2 years doing this, and then we finished that up, and I thought my wife Kathy, who is a librarian, she'd accepted a position with the Library of Congress. I'd accepted a position to go with the U.S. Attorney Civil Trial Division, Washington, D.C. We thought we were going that way. But a number of what would be your counterparts in Massachusetts, and we have 106 pension plans back in Massachusetts, a number of them approached me and said, "Look, we would like to engage a lawyer who can help us do a multitude of different things." Kathy and I never left Boston. And the first 20 years of my practice was working with plans like yourself on your litigation requirements, your ethical requirements, your fiduciary issues, your administrative issues. And during the 70s and 80s, your investment responsibilities were fairly mundane. You were primarily governed by what the statute would permit you to do. That changed when we started to do the studies, which resulted in the unfunded actuarial liability terminations. When states throughout the country found what was owed, they realized they had to do something. So the option was one or two. Either go back to the taxpayer and say, "We need to increase the amount of taxes to pay for these promises that we've made that have been unfunded," or we authorize these retirement systems to broaden their investment horizon to see if by looking at different types of investment approaches, could they help reduce the unfunded actuarial liability. That caused my life to change dramatically in the early 90s, because in the early 90s, if someone said to me, "Do you know what carried interest is on a private equity deal?" I'm going to look all of you right in the eye and say, "I wouldn't have had a clue what carried interest was back then." So I rebuilt the practice, rebuilt the team, so that we now spend 99% of our time working with clients like yourself on the various multitude of investment products that are offered to you, that are brought to you through your staff, through your consultants, so that when we look at any one of our clients, whether they're investing anywhere in the world, we feel that we've had the ability to work with your peers in multiple type of settings, so that we try to bring to each and every one of our clients that background and knowledge of the nuances. So what do we do? When we are engaged, we say to your staff, don't send us your workup in terms of why, from an investment viewpoint, you want to do the deal. Rather, send to me the documents, and let me look at the documents known as the private placement memorandum, the limited partnership agreement, the subscription document. Let me look at those documents. I will then come back to you with a memo, and it can be a very high overview memo, two or three pages, or it can be a much more detailed memo. We call it the briefing memo. And I will say to the staff, This is what the fund documents tell me. Is this what you think you're getting into? 8 out of 10 times, the briefing memo ties in with what your consultant and what your staff believes that you're going into. And then it's just simply a question of then putting together the side letter. And each one of you have different nuances on your side letters. My side letters for San Bernardino County are slightly different than my side letters for Orange County, slightly different than they are for San Francisco, so forth and so on. Each and every one of you have your own particular things that you want to have emphasized. Likewise, if I see things that I'm seeing throughout the country, like a big topic that we've had recently is not only as we work your way through what we call AB 2833, your fee transparency statute, but also we are now seeing a push by your counterparts throughout the country to say, if in fact we engage a manager and the manager is investigated by the SEC or the Department of Justice, what's been built into these documents for years has been the costs associated with that investigation, coupled with any settlement that they may pay, where the manager neither admits nor denies liability for the accusations brought by the Department of Justice or the SEC. The fund documents permit partnership assets to be used to pay for those expenses associated with defending that and settling it. Then a year ago this September, a manager used by a number of my clients, fortunately we weren't into this fund, but a manager known as Ock Ziff out of New York, a very large hedge fund manager, had invested a fund that focused strictly on Africa. And none of my clients were in that particular Ock Ziff fund. They were in other hedge fund funds offered by Ock Ziff. But Ock Ziff paid, in September of last year, a $416 million fine to settle Foreign Corrupt Practices Violations Act, bribery charges. That set off alarm bells with, even though all the years I've done this, I'd never seen that before. And we immediately talked to our clients and said, anybody in this? No. We need to have a discussion with Ock Ziff because, number one, $416 million, if it's coming out of partnership assets, never mind what the legal fees were to get to that point, coupled with, as we all know, all of us live, when we're serving, representing plan participants, serving as outside consultants or lawyers to firms, we live in a fishbowl. And to have a public pension plan that was making an investment with a manager who was paying a settlement charge for bribery, which is what this what these allegations were, that's something that's very uncomfortable. And lo and behold, Ock Ziff agreed that they weren't going to use that money out of the partnership assets. They would pay for it out of their own private insurance or out of their own pockets. But that set off an alarm bell. So I went to your colleagues, if you spoke to the San Bernardino County trustees, the Orange County trustees, any one of your peers that we happen to represent, we began a discussion with them around this time last year saying, do we want to start pushing that? And we have started pushing that. So one of the things that we try to do is say to our clients, even though you might not have seen this yet, this is something that we'd like to at least make you aware of. So we're starting to do that. The other thing that we do is, and this is something that I happen to love to do, as some of you may know, I give a number of speeches throughout the world. One of the great privileges for me is my chance to give back, particularly to my California clients. So I've spoken for a number of years at your SACRS conference, at your CALIPERS conference. That's my way of saying thank you, by the way. And I'm actually going to be speaking again in Burlingame in a couple of weeks. We're going to be speaking about a product that we designed for San Bernardino County, which, if you want to believe the literature at Harvard Law School, is going to revolutionize the way public pension plans invest in the future, and it's known as a managed custody account. Well, the SACRS Board of Directors has asked myself, Don Pierce, Tim's counterpart, the CIO down in San Bernardino County, to sort of, to at the investment breakout session, so Karen, I won't be in the attorney breakout session. They want us to take you, if you so wish, but in your colleagues, through this thing that is starting to, we're seeing changes through the industry. We're actually now seeing more and more plans start to say, all right, Tom, what is this MCA? Is this something that we want to do? And what it's done for San Bernardino County over the since we did the first one in 2012, it's lowered on an annualized basis their investment fees by $7 million a year. The other thing it does, it significantly lowers their legal fees because we haven't gotten into the details. Once the MCA is put over the manager, you don't have to talk to your outside counsel. Everything's all done. You can move in and out of different funds. You can go into direct investments, co-investments, and all of your fiduciary protections that you would want as public plan trustees, all of the safeguards for your particular system are baked into this 40 to 50 page MCA. So we see something like that, we try to bring
it. It must be an honor to be able to speak at Sackers.
When, yes.
That was the correct answer, by the way.
Yes.
We've heard him enough that he probably should get a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah. Well, that's my pleasure. When any of you see me at Sackers, and you might see me talking to my clients, those 3 days are probably, in May and in November, probably the three hardest days that I work each year, because I go there not only if anybody wants me to speak, I'm more than happy to do that, but you'll see me talking with my clients. And if you ever sat down, whether it be for coffee, lunch, dinner, or cocktails, you would see the dialogue is we're saying, all right, what's going on? What's new? What am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? That's those 3 days each May and November, my way of just saying, let's just sit down and talk. Nobody ever gets a bill for that. So, okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know we're getting short on time, but I was sitting here reflecting how differently things might have turned out had it been the state of Illinois that had engaged you as opposed to the state of Massachusetts.
Illinois is, I get contacted by them every now and then. I just want to just say thank you. No, we'll do Wisconsin. We've got a number of clients in Wisconsin, a number of clients down in Texas, and we'll work with them. But Illinois is so fraught with issues that it would take me, on my own time, get up to speed with what, if you were kind enough to engage us, on my own cost, I'll get up to speed with what are your particular nuances for your side letter. Illinois, I'd have to take 2 years and just say, I've got to learn. Yeah.
Jerry? Yeah, I understand you've been hired by several California pension funds. Has anybody ever let you go?
No. No. I'm pleased to say, and since I put the shingle out in the late 70s, I've never had a client let me go.
You indicated you have 100 lawyers in your group. That's a huge operation to both manage and keep on track, keep on top of. I'm assuming some of those specialize in California?
Yes. We have 5 offices in California, so that you would see if you engaged us, there are a number of lawyers in our San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego office that work with me for my clients out here, because particularly when it got into that AB 2833, the new fee transparency law, I needed help making sure, because I was appointed to the Sackers attorney breakout group that was focused on what should we be putting into the side letter. So particularly when it gets to California's laws, I'll rely on, we have 125 lawyers here in California.
Any other questions or comments?
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom.
Okay. I didn't bring up the Red Sox.
I was thinking that we could have thanked him for paying Pablo Sandoval's salary.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't go there.
How'd that work?
Well, he's back here now.
Yeah, but the Red Sox are paying him. It's a beautiful thing. Morning.
Good morning.
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 Another day in paradise, right?
Great.
It's another. The first guy went long, so you guys only have 5 minutes.
Okay. Right. So we've taken up 5 minutes, so we'll go ahead.
Feel free to introduce yourself.
Yeah, so we are 3 of the 7 partners in Jackson Walker's Investments Funds practice. I'm David Parrish. To my left is my colleague Phil Spahn, and then to his left, Nikki Brennig, from that perspective. So we, our firm is just a general service firm with offices only in Texas, which has been a strategic decision to keep costs low from that perspective across the platform. But our team represents, from a headcount perspective, about 8% of the total lawyers in the firm. We have a team of 22 lawyers that only represent institutional investors when they invest in public and private markets. So our team has 135 institutional investor clients that are made up of public pension plans, like yourselves, both city and state, throughout the country. So CalPERS, CalSTRS, University of California, LACERA, Illinois Teachers, Illinois CERS, Georgia ERS, Texas Teachers, groups like that. And then we also represent sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and in Australia, as well as a couple of U.S. sovereign wealth funds. We work with insurance companies, when they make their investments under fund of funds that raise capital and deploy their capital underneath into investments. We work with a tremendous number of university endowments throughout the United States. And then we work with development finance institutions like the World Bank and the European version of the World Bank when they invest. And then with, you know, what I would call kind of the institutionalized family offices, all in investments. So those investments will be in primary fund investments. It will be into co-investment transactions and in secondaries transactions. And that team then runs across the asset allocation model. So we have people who do mostly venture investments, people who do, you know, kind of private equity and growth, ranging from kind of early stage and late stage growth and to the low middle market buyout, all the way to the biggest funds, you know, the mega buyout funds, Apollo, Blackstone, Carlyle. But we also do real assets, which is a mixture of real estate, infrastructure, energy, and commodities. We do credit investments for our clients. We also work with them on long and only funds and then absolute relative return funds, kind of the hedge fund type space as well. And so that's really is an overview, just what we do. We don't intentionally, and this is an intentional decision, we don't represent GPs in their negotiations with investors on an institutional basis because we don't want to be conflicted from that perspective in terms of the quality and the substance of advice that we do. In addition to the work, we're also highly involved in the educational space. So we are the folks that teach the Institutional Limited Partners Association coursework on private markets legal documentation and how you should view risk in documents and how you can close risk off at, or help underwrite around particular risk that's unrelated to the strategy. So I talk way too fast, so let me stop, but I also want to be sensitive because I just think I just used up 3 minutes and 27 seconds. So let me stop there. All
right? Don't be nervous.
Yeah.
It looks like a green light or red light system. My name is Phil Spahn. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for providing the opportunity to us. My practice generally focuses more on real estate, energy, and infrastructure funds. But in addition to what David said, I want to talk just a minute about kind of staffing and how we use our group and kind of start off and look at relationships. I think our experience has borne out that you find efficiencies from consistency. And so what we would expect is that going forward, you'll have some primary contacts, the three of us, to start deals and to really oversee and run those deals for you. As we go forward, as David mentioned, we have a team of about 22 folks who focus on representing institutional LPs and all sorts of various investments and types of asset classes he described. And as we go forward, you'll be introduced to those folks. We'll find the right mix, the folks who communicate how you like to be communicated with, the style as well as the substance to make sure it's the right fit. Because we do, proud of the team we've built out, and it's an exceptional group of people, but want to be thoughtful about how we introduce ourselves and start working to you so we find those efficiencies, so we find that consistency, so we're always hitting that right point. So that's something we'll kind of, there'll be a dialogue we would expect going forward about how we build the team, who's working with you, but know that you'll always have a partner there kind of looking, either running the deal to start or heavily involved just to make sure things are done in that consistent, efficient manner.
I'm Nikki Brennick. I have been practicing since 2004, sort of solely in the investment fund space. My practice focuses sort of across the asset class, but primarily on private equity, venture capital, co-investments, and secondaries transactions.
Yeah, and a couple of things to supplement. One, we do see a lot of efficiencies in the practice. Since we see a large portion of the marketplace, nobody sees everything from that perspective, or if they do, they're not telling you the truth because there's just too much out there for any one particular group to see. But we will see a lot of overlap from time to time in investments. So we'll have the most extreme case, we had 17 different clients going into one particular fund. And all of those clients benefited from the infrastructure that we have and the team, that you never want to be in a situation where you're reinventing the wheel from that perspective. So even though we would work with you all to define a team, because nobody ever wants to be interfacing with 22 different people, you can't just develop the natural kind of communication style that you want. From time to time, if there's a fund you are looking at and we've already had someone who isn't on your quote-unquote team, who's worked on that, we would want to be able to introduce them to the relationship from that perspective, because it just doesn't make sense to not use and take advantage of the knowledge base that's already existed from that perspective.
That said, I think we are sort of cognizant that not all clients see every issue the same as another client, and so to the extent that a client's not comfortable with, you know, the same people representing a number of clients, or want to make sure that we have a separate team for a particular client to negotiate issues that matter to them, we completely understand that and do that sometimes.
That's
as
right.
Well,
so. Absolutely. But also to be mindful of time as well, to let you all know, we do, we are very familiar with California Public Records Act, right? The Open Meetings Act, AB 2833, and the fee disclosure from that perspective. We've worked through all of those issues. We understand how your immunities work. We understand, you know, how the California Constitution operates. We do have a very large client base in California, both on the public side, but also on the private side as well in the endowment space.
A question I didn't think of asking other gentlemen this earlier, but do you put any kind of like a newsletter or anything that would, well, go ahead.
Well, that's a great question. Let me let you finish it, though.
Yeah. Oh, that was it.
Yeah. So the answer is it's on our agenda from that perspective. It's one of those things where we're always trying to figure out a way to enhance the value we provide. And one of the things we've been talking about doing and trying to implement, and I would say that we're 6 months behind schedule on it, kind of trying to make sure we're getting everything done the way it needs to be done for all of our clients, is be able to give people an overview of kind of their terms and how they're negotiating those terms across asset classes or even within just private markets generally, and then show them, you know, kind of what we're seeing in the greater marketplace, and let people call us and say, because we have this tremendous amount of data that we're not effectively utilizing, but I'd like for people to be able to call up and say, I want to know an emerging markets credit in the private structure, what my fees might be, or what percentage of deals are going to have a no-fault removal or a haircut on a for-cause removal. What does that look like? We have the data, and we're right now talking to a third-year intern at the University of Colorado Law School who's working with one of our clients to help build out that database and then pair that up with probably a business school intern to build a database and the underlying, expose my lack of technological vocabulary, but basically build an algorithm to go into our database and pull everything together so that we can provide that in a more sophisticated basis. My long-term plan would be able to give that to our clients on a quarterly basis. I think, you know, it's going to make more sense to do it on an annual basis and then kind of scale it to every semi-annual basis, because I think there's some infrastructure that we need to build around to get that. But we talk to our clients pretty frequently about what we see in the marketplace, but we haven't actually put an actual template out, because I don't want to put something out that, you know, at times you can let the perfect become the enemy of the good, but I want to make sure what you deliver is good if you're going to do something like that.
And one additional way that some of that information we've worked on to get that out into the public is through some of the trade groups we've talked about, ILPA, PREA, NAPA. We're heavily involved in those groups, and particularly on some of the committees that are writing their research reports and putting information out there in the marketplace. And so while it's not a Jackson Walker newsletter product, we're involved in those organizations and can help track that down, because there's some fantastic research that comes through each of those organizations, management fee structures, impact of different types of waterfall structures and various things like that, offsets and how they're working in the marketplace. So oftentimes it may not be something we've done, but we can help track it down because we've been involved in some ways in the background.
Right.
Scott? I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to articulate this correctly, but you represent LPs exclusively, right?
Yes.
So when you have a multitude of your clients involved in an investment, a single investment, Where do the benefits of sort of the commonality of the investment end and then the individual client representation begin? How does that work in a group of 22?
Well, the answer to that question is it kind of breaks down in a bunch of different ways, right? So there's an economic benefit in the sense that your total cost to execute the transaction is going to be lower because your costs have been defrayed and spread across a larger platform. So there's an economic benefit from that perspective. In terms of a leverage benefit in negotiating terms, that benefit's only going to exist if the investment staffs of those different organizations are on the same page, right? And if that doesn't mean that one investment staff member is better than somebody else. It just, you know, there's an organizational overlay, right? And so different people do deals for different reasons, or where a particular investment fits within somebody's portfolio for different reasons. But if there is commonality of mindset, like everybody wants to get together and kind of reduce the overall gross net return spreads down so they can come in and negotiate a lower fee and a delay on the start of that fee until the day of the first investment, as opposed to when the fund actually has a close. If you've got, you know, somewhere between 8 to 20% or more of the total fund capital looking at that deal, it puts you in a situation where if everybody's on the same page, you actually have more leverage with the manager to right. actually push the terms across. And sometimes the way funds get raised and the way people track terms and comments, you know, the more consistency you have in terms of making the comments, even if they're not the most important comments to you, if you submit them, you know, those will rise up to a threshold level the GP will say, my market is speaking to me and I need to address it. So you can have leverage, you'll have the ability to improve the leverage and outcome for yourself, which will fundamentally either mean your economics are more truly aligned, or even if it's not an economic feature, that your risk unrelated to successful issues of the strategy is improved, right? So there's less for your team to actually have to underwrite around from that perspective, or you can find yourself just at the base case of just having a reduced overall cost to enter into the transaction. I'm really good at long-winded answers.
Yeah, it just seems to me, I mean, in a relatively closed environment of 22, and if you have a multiple of clients involved in a particular investment with a particular manager, that
right.
when you have differing interests across those various funds, right, who might be investing, how that's internally managed. I'm kind of that's really what
well,
I'm trying
so,
to get
so
at.
Well, so the internal management issue really turns on kind of the client comfort, right? So we wouldn't represent multiple clients unless each of those clients were okay with that, number one. And some clients want to try to collaborate, and others say, well, no, we don't want to collaborate. We have our own goals from that perspective. So you have to isolate and just negotiate that client's best interest in each circumstances. Like when you have 17 funds going into a single manager, from that perspective, you can't have one person do all that. Right? It's just physically impossible. So you'll build a team from that perspective. But you can also, if the clients are interested in talking to each other, you can put clients in touch with each other. But you can just manage it by saying, you know, kind of what are your core needs, and make sure we address that. And so it's really not been a significant challenge to us to execute those transactions. Inevitably, like, you know, someone might say, well, I don't want to have to negotiate because I only have a $25 million commitment, and I know somebody with a $750 million commitment is going to negotiate that. Well, the $750 million commitment probably negotiates a lot less than you think because they have nowhere else to go, right? There's very few places that can take that big of a check from that perspective. So by the time they've gotten to the point of engaging legal, right, and the legal cost before you close exposes yourself to broken deal risk, they're going to have a high degree of confidence that not only are they going to do that deal no matter what the terms are, but that particular manager fits within their portfolio in a meaningful way. They're very less likely to get down too far into minutiae and take care of the collective, because they're really trying to organizationally make sure they can meet their return targets and their allocation targets and hopefully get some fee discount from that perspective. So there are a lot of things that go into it. It's really about making sure you're giving people the advice that investment staff and legal staff of the client want and need and value. And you've got to be able to kind of make those calls and have that conversation.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Hopefully we didn't run you too long. Put you back on schedule.
Want to break the bad news to the next group, they have no time.
Yeah.
Probably a better reason
to sit outside.
Thank you very much.
Great to see
you. Grab a snack before the next group.
It's coming from the $600 an hour, three of them there for 15 minutes.
Oh, I believe that, yeah. I was talking to my LA folks yesterday and said, well, no, okay, now I know what it's like to be there full time.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I only go in and out, but oh, goodness. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, and then the floor is yours.
Okay, hi. So I'm Sonia Giuseppe, and I'm a partner in the San Francisco office of K&L Gates.
Mark Heine, and I'm a partner in the Seattle office.
And so do you want us just to give an overview of our firm and our practice area? All right.
Absolutely.
So we are both at K&L Gates, and even though I'm in San Francisco and Mark is in Seattle, we work together quite frequently. I talk to the Seattle office several times a day. And so K&L Gates, just to give you a background, it's a very large law firm. We have about 2,000 lawyers. We're throughout the United States, Australia, Asia, Brazil, and Europe. So it's great that we have, you know, we're able to focus within our own groups and work with a team, but then we also have a lot of expertise outside of our little silo group. So it's very easy to pick up the phone and call anybody who is in another time zone or another country and has, you know, if there's some like question, it may seem like a random question about, say, Australia insurance for whatever reason, we can find the right expert and talk with that person. So it works out very well. And then personally, so I have been with the firm since 2008 in San Francisco. My practice is I'm in the investment management group, so I work with some asset managers and then also a lot of institutional investors. So my institutional investor clients are range from family offices to endowments, also fund of funds, and then several pension funds. And I specifically work with several pension funds in California, including some that are right bordering counties of where we are right now. And so I really enjoy the work, and I work on all different aspects of reviewing their investments for them. So work any type of fund, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and then anything else that falls in some other different type of category. And working with them going into commingled vehicles, so with multiple different investors, and also doing, especially lately, it's been a lot more of the like funds of one or separate account type vehicles. And so that's always interesting. Negotiating power varies based on how much money my clients want to give up to these managers, and then also, you know, how successful the managers are in terms of what they're going to give on. So it's I enjoy the work a lot, and it's very interesting for me.
I'm sorry, you picked an interesting year to begin in 08.
Yeah. I was very, very fortunate to get a job, let's put it that way. A lot of people didn't have weren't so lucky as I was.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I was just going to drill down a little more on the specific practice group. Okay, now we have a pretty broad IM group generally. Most of our East Coast folks work on the GP side, sponsor side. In Seattle and San Francisco, though, we have a core, which I'll call a subgroup of attorneys. Sonia, myself, Margaret Niles, Charles Purcell, you may be aware of, and a few other supporting folks that, you know, primarily do just institutional investor on the LP side. And this is what we've done. I began at Preston Gates and Ellis, who was later merged with K&L to become K&L Gates in 2000. So I have been reading, reviewing, and writing closed-end and open-end alternative investment documents for 17 years. It's a great practice. I enjoy what I do. It's stimulating. And I think we provide a very efficient, solid work product to our clients. I think having, I personally do a little bit of GP work, and I think it's important to have to see what's important on the GP side. So coming into any deal on the institutional investor side, to know what is critical to them, to know what's critical to us on the LP side, makes for what I think generally is an understanding of what's important there, what's important for us, and generally a smooth negotiation. You know, that doesn't mean there aren't critical issues. I mean, when you boil down to it, you're fighting over money and allocation of risk, and when you hire money manager, conflicts. So it's good to see both sides of the street.
Is the firm able to work both sides, GP, LP, with an ethical barrier? I mean, y'all do that?
Yeah, no, we do run in conflicts from time to time, and unfortunately do have to pass on deals where there is a, you know, direct conflict where maybe someone in our Boston office is actually representing the GP. And, yeah. You know, unfortunately it happens.
And on the GP side, it's a lot of our managers are hedge fund managers. So for the private equity and venture capital type investments that pension funds do, we usually don't have conflicts there. Not to say that doesn't ever happen, but
right.
We do, I mean, we either do a wall or else, you know, just will not take the work if our clients feel like they don't want to go through with the conflict check. Because especially, you know, there's all these different issues that may come about, but we're perfectly fine with having walls up. And it works out very well.
Our clients have a wide spectrum of feelings on conflicts. We have one client that's anything remote, you know, we have other counsel, and that's fine. We have some that say, well, we don't really care.
And everything in between.
Is there a lead partner that you would describe in your firm for this client?
It
wasn't as clear to me.
Yeah, so I mean, it's probably partly just the fact that we are a team. and so sometimes the lead partner will manifest over time in terms of, you know, who is the point person, but we're flexible in terms of assigning someone or letting the relationship grow naturally and then having that one point person.
So there hasn't been one assigned before, I mean, up to this point, okay.
I'm not aware of one, yeah. But it's we do whatever you would like us to do.
Yeah, I think the primary contact would probably be Margaret and or Charles.
Yeah.
But then from there, you know, we have a pretty wide supporting team.
Yeah.
You know, so, and quite frankly, you know, they're very senior attorneys. It doesn't make economic sense for them to do all the work.
It would just seem to me that the staff might be interested in having someone who is
typically
a default contact
person.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, the default contact person varies upon the relationship. So for some clients, I'm the key contact. Mark is for others, and then Charles or Margaret would be for a different one. So again, it's just kind of how the relationship comes to us in part, and then just how it grows organically.
Okay.
And sometimes it's not even a conscious decision from our end,
right?
Yeah. We'll just have clients, they'll email me.
But
and
yeah.
It's just kind of that relationship happens over time.
And then within our group, we also, because we are in a few different offices, but we do a weekly call with each other on Tuesdays. So we try to keep informed with what everyone's doing on that call. And then we also have an email group that we send emails to each other. And then we're all friends, too.
Right,
so it's all very easy for us to pick up the phone and call each other and just kind of figure out what's going on. But we don't ever want anyone to slip through the cracks. That
and
wouldn't occur.
Yeah, and one important point about just having a key person and a deep team, you know, say, for example, you guys wanted to look at a fund, you contact Margaret, and we have somebody else looking at the same fund. Well, you know, from a economy scale standpoint, it only makes sense for that person to do the review. And, you know, that makes it efficient for everybody.
Okay.
You may have just answered it, but going back to GPLP, how do you determine internally whether there may be a conflict and that you may be representing both sides?
So anytime we get a new matter, we'll do a conflicts check on it. So you would call us up and say, hey, you know, we want to invest in big growth energy, which doesn't exist that I know of. And so then we send that to our conflicts department for big growth energy. And then we would look at all of the different, like the key people there and their affiliates. I mean, it's challenging in the fact that companies are so large nowadays, right? And firms are so large nowadays, but we would do a thorough check on all the affiliates or affiliated names as well, and then if there's a hit that comes up, and a hit would be that someone else represents that matter, then we determine, you know, is that matter still open? Is it closed? Did that person leave the firm 10 years ago? And so, you know, there's no one that's ever done that work anymore, and then we would inform you as to what the situation is, and then we would proceed from there. We also have a general counsel's office that can look into more stickier issues if those do arise. But we would inform you before the process even starts.
And it's a thorough enough process where even very tangent-related hits will come up.
So every new client that you have goes through this process. That is captured
Yes.
And
so it's every new client and then every new matter. Right. So it would be Contra Costa, if you guys were a client, would be the client. And then if you wanted to invest in Big Growth Energy would be a new matter, and we would do a check on that one to make sure that there's no issues there.
And we'd be going through that process with any prospective law firm that would be looking at getting that full disclosure and then making a determination about who is best positioned to represent Contra Costa.
Yeah. I mean, if there was any law firm that didn't do that, you would probably want to change law firm. So, yeah, everyone is doing that.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Working on kid stuff. Do your kids until your room temperature, right? Okay. Even when they're adults?
That room's a little larger than yours, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just the hairs.
Okay.
Getting updates on the urgent.
The Australian office.
No, there's a lower.
Yeah, when I need something, you know, in the New York office.
Yeah, right.
They do watch
my kids, my 26-year-old son.
We had similar.
There's too much information. Let me tell you everything that's going on in my life. My other kids, not as much.
I'll take care of it. I'll take it from here.
Yeah, exactly.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So if you wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, and then the floor is yours.
So I'm Parik Dasgupta. I'm a partner in the fund formation practice at Reed Smith, and I'm based in the New York office. I graduated from Harvard Law School, and then initially I was with another firm called Kirkland Ellis, where I basically trained to become a funds lawyer. I then co-founded the New York office for a British firm, King & Wood Mallesons, where I represented a lot of the European funds and Asian funds. And in that role, I did a lot of work on the GP side, where my specialist role was actually negotiating with pension plans, so which is where I developed a lot of skill set in this particular arena, especially with dealing with nuances that any public pension plans brings with it, you know, the must-haves that every states have, and to know where the GPs are, where the market is. And now do the same practice at Reed Smith in the New York office.
Good morning. My name is Rana Ansari. I'm a mid-level corporate associate in the San Francisco office. I am not, my general background has been general corporate. I've been with Reed Smith 5 years, half of that in the litigation practice, and more recently, in more recent years on the corporate side, more of a general practice, M&A primarily, commercial contract review. And more recently have been working with the funds team in sort of getting trained up sort of from a succession plan standpoint, getting part of a group or team and specializing, looking at limited partnership agreements and LLC agreements to sort of aggregate data and sort of understand market trends so that we can put it together for kind of a client use purposes in understanding the market trends. I also our financial industry group, I've been doing sort of diligence on these funds from the standpoint of lending in, as part of their professional loan program. But again, all of that's sort of more recent as I'm sort of specializing in my mid-level years. I'll give kind of a general brief overview. I mean, I think you're all sort of familiar with Reed Smith, with Harvey Lederman, our client relationship partner, having a track record of 10 years with this county. He apologizes that he couldn't be here today, but basically, you know probably our firm, but we have a global footprint. We have 1,700 attorneys across 27 offices, and I think we truly are global in footprint, beyond just the number of offices, but just in terms of our level of collaboration, and actually it really feels a lot more of a smaller, tight-knit network, and it's kind of hard for me to believe that we are a global firm, because it really feels kind of more of a small-knit family. And I've practiced both in our San Francisco office and our New York office, and have worked on M&A private equity deals with our Chicago office, so, and obviously running corporate deals, we are usually, as the deal lawyers, sort of on the front end of diligence and on the front end of sort of the leading the transaction, and so working with specialists, so kind of have an expertise in who to reach out to in our various offices for the various areas of expertise.
So how long ago did you form the New York practice group?
So the Reed Smith New York practice group has always been there. I set up the New York practice group for my previous firm. That was my background. That was about, in 2014, I set up the New York office for that firm.
Okay. And emphasis, LPs, GPs?
Yes. So predominantly most of my work is GP representation across a wide area of strategies, infrastructure, buyout, venture, credit, real asset, debt. But I also do a significant amount of LP representation work for sovereign wealth funds, for funds of funds, and public pension plans.
Yeah, I was trying to get a feel for, you know, the public pension fund, particularly the California funds.
Yeah,
it's likely an LP position,
so
right?
There most of my exposure to California funds have come from representing from the GP side, because my role for the last 2-3 years has been the specialist person in my previous firm and this firm to negotiate on behalf of the GPs with public pension plans across U.S. So I do all the side letters and I do all the other requests, LPA negotiations with the public pension plans, and that skill set, that is the skill set that I'm translating to the LP representation for public pension plans now. But most of it historically has been GP representation against public pension plans.
And then, of course, with Harvey being sort of the fiduciary counsel in our firm, advising on the fiduciary responsibilities, it's also interconnected, and we have that sort of rapport to be able to sort of bounce ideas and make sure that from a fiduciary standpoint, the deal terms correspond to the fiduciary obligations.
So it sounds like that the game plan is you were trained and steeped in the GP side, and now you use that skill set to negotiate with them. Is that?
Yeah. So that's that's how it's transpiring. I have the skill set because of that work in my previous firm, but as I've come here and I've got more and more LP work, and I have always had LP clients, it's the same knowledge, but I'm not like negotiating against the same GPs, because those GPs were Europe based, those were Asia based. Obviously the COVID would be conflicted out, but. I'm using the same skill set, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you.
You're likening that to going from the defense counsel to the DA's office?
No, it's all. you go with what you know, right?
Do you envision, or have you identified kind of a lead individual that would be a primary contact for the staff here, or are they just supposed to start with the phone book and see who might be able to help?
No, so Avi Lederman is obviously the relationship partner. But I've been getting the
Harvey
contact
Lederman
person
is.
For the funds.
So, Harvey, okay.
Yeah,
well.
Harvey Lederman is the relationship partner for.
But who is he going to immediately say you should be talking to?
Me.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, I also bring in the lower client billable rate. So to the extent anything can be offset and I can assist on, that's also an asset.
Yeah. No, we obviously work as a team across different levels appropriately, but yes, I would be the point person in terms of managing the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the trustees? Great. Thank you very much for
your
time.
Thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Additional comments?
No. Happy to take any questions from the trustees, but we do have a recommendation from the staff embedded in the memo to establish a pool, execute engagement letters with the three additional firms, maintain the relationship with Reed Smith, and authorize staff to work with any of the four firms on an as-needed basis.
So moved.
Second.
I just wanted to thought, it's entirely up to you guys, but this idea somehow seems a little nebulous, the contact. You know, do you call Sonia? Do you call this person, do you call Harvey, and then eventually, I assume you're going to establish a relationship with someone who becomes your point of contact.
Yes. And some of that is nebulous simply because we need to get to know the cross-section of the partners. I think, you know, certainly from the dialogue that we've had on the executive team, we have in mind who we believe is probably our point person, but we need to work a couple deals with them to establish that. Yeah. But that would all be kind of come together over the next year.
Because I'd feel better on your behalf if that was a little bit better gelled.
I think, you know,
forward basis.
I don't want to speak on behalf of everybody else here, but I think we've got a pretty concrete idea of who we're going to be engaging with.
Okay.
We're open to expansion of that team, but there's a very concrete idea with each firm who is our point person.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would say it's a good idea that it's desirable to have a Harvey who has a significant additional revenue base in serving us as a relationship partner. If for any reason Tim is unhappy or Gail with the way we're being served, letting Harvey know that has far more impact in the firm itself. Now, I'm assuming that this work in the past has all been done by Reed Smith.
Correct.
So they're really losing a chunk, prospectively. Have you dealt with either of the two individuals that in that process up until now that we just spoke with?
In terms of kind of past work practice and everything, Peric has... newly on the Contra Costa account, we're engaged with him right now on the StepStone contract for private credit. I've been working with him extensively over the course of the summer. Karen's been working with him extensively more recently. So, yeah, we are engaged in a project currently.
And the previous legacy investments that we had Reed Smith work on throughout time have been managed on the Reed Smith side by Benton Burroughs. He's on their team. He's an excellent lawyer. And definitely recommend having him on the team going forward in case there's legacy issues that come up in the future.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? It was seconded, correct?
Yes.
Motion on the table to accept staff's three recommendations. All those in favor say.
Oh, yeah. No.
Four.
Well, there's three recommendations.
Three recommendations. I'm sorry. Email or memo.
Sorry for the confusion. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes.
A lot of work. Thank you, guys.
Tim, I have a quick question about mitigating risk.
The travel.
I have a question about mitigating risk with respect to investments in private equity. Mm-hmm. So we will have at least two layers. One is the due diligence that your team investigates and researches the investment and the group and so forth.
Right.
And then the second layer would be having the attorneys review the deal to make sure we're protected, we've got the right contract language and so forth, correct? And then is there another step or is there another step needed? I mean, is there insurance? Just in case there's fraud involved or something else that happens.
So from the due diligence of the investment thesis, that's handled both at the consultant level, so either coming through Verus or StepStone, depending on what the asset class is, if they're involved. So we have that additional input. My staff is going through it and identifying, you know, the investment thesis and any choke points, any concerns, that sort of thing. Then we have the legal counsel coming in saying, here's where your fiduciary protections are and helping to guide that. So we have two sets of teams running through the investment thesis and a separate team running through the legal to bring it all together in terms of making sure our fiduciary protections are in there. Unfortunately, when it comes to fraud, that is something that we have to take a look at. We hope to catch it in one of these two processes, and certainly from the consultancy side, we bring in operational due diligence, which is going to do background checks and that sort of thing. As you well know, if somebody is bound and determined to commit fraud, they will commit fraud. Our thesis is, let's try to identify any markers that we think are, you know, soft. Let's do our background checks. If somebody is bound and determined to commit it, they're going to commit it through diversification and the investment process. We hope to weed it out. The reality is we're never going to weed it out completely. But no, there's not an insurance policy per se for Contra Costa. There's usually directors and officers insurance, E&O insurance, that'll cover some of that, and that's at the general partnership level.
Okay.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, item 6A.